This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, companies are investing millions and millions of dollars on the world of virtual reality. We'll learn more about what's known as the metaverse and why it's getting so much hype lately. Now, a proposal in Wisconsin's state assembly would lower the age required to apply for a concealed carry permit from 21 to 18. 18 to 20-year-olds are allowed to purchase firearms, but they're not allowed to purchase from licensed dealers. Instead, must buy from private sellers. We're talking now about concealed carry and gun rights and regulations for 18 to 20-year-olds here in the state. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you in favor of concealed carry generally? Do you think that the age should go from 21 down to 18 to apply for concealed carry permits? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Shay Sortwell is a Republican from Two Rivers representing Wisconsin's 2nd Assembly District. He's sponsoring this assembly bill that would lower the minimum age to apply for a concealed carry permit. Representative Sortwell, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Can you tell us why you want to lower the age here for concealed carry from 21 to 18?
Sure. You know, the issue is pretty basic. And I know, you know, you kind of kicked it off with this idea of this thing about gun rights and everything. But actually, I would actually say that it goes beyond gun rights. And it goes to the basic premise of equality under the law. And really, it's not really so much about the Second Amendment as it is about the 14th Amendment, which is that anybody who is an adult should be treated equally under the law. You know, if we have somebody who's 18, 19, or 20 years old, they have the same rights as somebody who's 22, 23, 24, 25, or 99 years old. And so that's what really this is about, is it's saying we can't kind of artificially pick an age and deny somebody an inherent right, the inherent right to defend yourself, simply because they're not 21 years old yet. If they are an adult, they have those inherent rights, and it is our duty under the Constitution to respect everybody's rights.
We do have some cases, some products, alcohol and tobacco, notably, where we do divide different kinds of adults, 18 to 20, 21 and up. I think you just hinted at this being a constitutional right. How would you distinguish, say, firearms from alcohol and tobacco?
Sure. Well, you know, we can have that discussion. And to be honest, I really am somebody who does support kind of one age of majority, that, you know, at that age, you know, we should treat you as an adult. And I think we should do that. If we want to choose 21, well, we can choose 21. But even on that, despite that distinction where I think the state should go and simply say, this is when you're an adult and you can vote and you can make contracts and you can drink and everything else. Even beyond that, though, I'm not aware of any provision in the Constitution, state or federally, that lists, you know, the inherent right to drink alcohol. Mm-hmm. But it does specifically say in the Constitution of the state that you have, that adults have a right to possess firearms for self-defense, for hunting, and for any other legal purpose. And then we have the Second Amendment of the federal Constitution that lists those rights. And so, you know, that's how this is different, is that we acknowledge this as an inherent right. And if it's an inherent right, it must be equal to all of our adult citizens.
Now, some critics of the idea to lower the law have pointed toward this sort of weird bit of federal law when it comes to the purchase of firearms by 18 to 20-year-olds. As I understand it, 18 to 20-year-olds can't buy them from licensed dealers and go through background checks. They can buy them privately. They're just worried, I think, about the more difficult to track and difficult to background check zone that would put these 18 to 20-year-olds in. Do you have thoughts on that concern?
Well, first of all, I would note that a circuit court this past summer actually noted that that's probably unconstitutional law right now anyways, to prohibit 18, 19, and 20-year-olds from purchasing handguns, once again, on kind of an arbitrary fashion. There's really no good reason why they should be denied those rights. And so that we'll see if that continues forward. That may end up being thrown out in our federal Supreme Court, say that you need to treat everybody equally before the law as it relates to that right as well. But even beyond that, even under current law, yes, it is true that somebody cannot purchase a firearm from a licensed dealer. They can either get it from a parent, they can get it, as you mentioned, from you know, private party selling. But that's the point, isn't it? Is that's already legal under the law. They can already possess it in that way. What we are saying is, well, if you can already possess it, shouldn't we be able to simply follow the process that's in place right now for you to go to the state and go through the process and say, look, I've got training on how to use this firearm? I mean, do we feel safer right now with the idea that you can go out and buy it with, and we have no idea that you got it, rather than, hey, you know, Bill or Johnny or Sally decided to go out and get this permit, and now we know that you've got this permit and went through the training, so you actually know how to use them.
And as we wrap up, Representative Sortwell, what do you think about the prospects for passing this and the timeline?
I think it's going to pass in the Assembly tomorrow. Right, it's on the calendar for tomorrow, and I would be surprised if we don't move it through the full legislature. I think a lot of people understand that we need to treat everybody equally before the law.
Representative Sortwell, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
Shay Sortwell is a Republican from Two Rivers representing Wisconsin's 2nd Assembly District. He talked to us about a bill he's sponsoring that would lower the minimum age to obtain a concealed carry permit from 21 to 18. You can join in with your thoughts on that idea at 800-642-1234. Now we're going to look at how this fits into concealed carry laws around the country and regulations for younger gun owners. Robert Spitzer is Distinguished Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the State University of New York at Cortland, author of over a dozen books, including 5 on gun policy. The most recent is The Politics of Gun Control. Robert, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
So Wisconsin, we allow concealed carry 21 and up. This law would change it to 18 to 20. How does that fit in with concealed carry laws around the country?
Well, it is part of a broader movement that we've seen in recent years to loosen concealed carry laws and to make it easier for people to get guns and to carry, so for civilians to carry them about with them. The thing is, people think of that as a return to our past, but it's actually the opposite of our past. From the late 1600s to the start of the 20th century, every state in the country except 3 restricted or completely barred civilian gun carrying. It's only been in the last few decades, beginning in the 1980s, where we've seen a new movement to make it easier for civilians to carry guns around with them. And there are perfectly good, there's a legal constitutional question, but there's also a public policy question. And I think the idea of reducing the age from 21 to 18 raises a number of troubling problems, both with respect to public policy. And I don't think it imposes an undue constitutional burden to keep the age at 21.
What problems do you see it raising?
Well, most immediately, you're talking about making handguns accessible to the ages 18 to 20. And we know that late teenagers in that age period are part of the cohort of people more likely to commit crimes. Most crimes are committed by young adults. In addition, we know that teenagers are still developing. They tend to be more impulsive, more subject to mood swings, that they tend to lack judgment and experience. They're subject to depression, anger. And we know that when handguns become more accessible, that is to say, when people turn 21, gun suicides increase. And it does matter what you use if you're contemplating suicide, and a gun is the most lethal method of suicide available. So it poses a risk in terms of suicide and also in terms of acting out behavior that we have seen repeatedly in the news.
As you heard from Representative Sortwell there, though, if we're making laws regarding things that are in the Constitution related to constitutional rights, shouldn't we treat all people we agree who are adults equally?
Well, the question begins with, what do you mean by an adult? And as you pointed out in the discussion, age of adulthood, depending on the activity involved, can range in the modern era from 18 to 21. But that question aside, we know that the Second Amendment does not bar gun regulation. Restricting guns from young people goes back decades and, in fact, nearly 200 years in our own past. And the government in general has wide latitude to regulate firearms. That also is part of the little known story of our gun past. And as a matter of public policy, the government is well within its rights to say that For something, for a responsibility as significant as gun ownership, we believe that we should set the bar a little higher rather than a little lower. There's nothing magical about 18 versus 21. It depends on the activity. And given the history of gun regulations in all of these areas, the government, it seems to me, is well within its rights to impose regulations. And I would just add that the Fourth Circuit federal court decision that struck down gun regulations, rather handgun restrictions to 18, 19, and 20-year-olds was a decision that was then reversed a couple of months later. So the current law is not in the Fourth Circuit, sustains the 21-year-old age limit.
Let's bring on a caller now. Tom is with us in Lac du Flambeau. Tom, hi.
Hello.
What did you want to bring up, Tom?
I'm wondering, I mean, I'm all for the concealed carry to go down to 18, but like the purchasing of firearms, they should be able to purchase them at 18 as well.
Tom, thanks for the call. And that is kind of a weird wrinkle in federal law that we mentioned earlier, Bob, that, and correct me if I'm wrong, 18 to 20-year-olds can't buy from a federal licensed dealer who does background checks. They could buy from any other private gun seller. Could you talk about that, a bit of weirdness?
Yeah, that's exactly right, because the federal regulation occurs via the restrictions and the regulations that pertain to a federally licensed firearms dealer, an FFL. But in most states, you can purchase guns privately from a private person who, you know, wants to sell some guns or sells some guns on the side and who is not a licensed dealer and therefore doesn't fall under the federal rubric. It does seem a bit odd, and I think it's simply a limitation in terms of how that law is written. But it's true that if you're 18, 19, 20, and it's legal for you to get a handgun, yes, you could buy it from a private dealer.
Tom, thanks for calling on from Lac du Flambeau. Bob Spitzer is with us, Distinguished Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the State University of New York, Cortland, talking to us about concealed carry policies, and especially those for gun owners between 18 and 20. A proposed Wisconsin law would lower the minimum age for concealed carry from 21 to 18. You can join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see that change made? If you have questions about how this works, what precedents there are around the country, you could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Right now, we're picking up our talk with political scientist Bob Spitzer about laws on gun ownership and concealed carry under age 21. That is the current minimum age for concealed carry in Wisconsin. A proposal in the state legislature, we talked to one of the sponsors earlier, would lower that to 18. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on that or your questions. 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Blake is with us in Madison. Blake, hi.
Hi. So I'm a person of color for Madison. I'm a concealed carry holder. I'm all for the expansion of rights for permissible gun owners, 18, 19, and 20. I think this is just an evolution of Wisconsin politics. We saw the unbanning of automatic knives, which was originally in place to go after Hispanic and Black youths when switchblades were popular. I think this is just an evolution of that, where we're allowing permissible gun owners to practice their rights at 18, 19, and 20. These people can already vote. They can already own handguns and firearms. I don't see any reason we should bar them from a constitutional right. Thank you.
Blake, thanks for the call. Bob, what do you think?
Well, interesting point. He mentioned in passing knives. I'm assuming he's referring to what sometimes people call switchblades.
Right.
And I've spent a lot of time looking at old gun laws. One of the things you find is that when gun carrying was restricted, and again, this goes back over 200 years in America, so were certain specific name types of knives. Knives that had long, thin blades or concealed blades that were used in interpersonal fighting. So the regulation of knives, in certain types of knives, is actually as old as the regulation of concealed carry. Again, back to the 1800s and 1700s.
Blake, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Jim joins us now in Cedarburg. Jim, hi.
Thanks, Rob. I'd like to talk about the first half of the Second Amendment, basically militia types being regulated by the president, as it's stated. These people who aligned themselves or affiliated themselves with militias back in January 6th, shouldn't we have these people's names?
Jim, I don't want to go necessarily to January 6th here, Bob, but the idea he's mentioning the well-regulated militia part of the Second Amendment, has that part, as Jim says, gotten kind of lost in the ways laws have changed?
It kind of has gotten lost, and it's still in the amendment as much now as the day it was written back in 1789. But in terms of the people involved in the January 6th uprising in Washington, D.C. from last year, they called themselves militias, but they're not militias, and they were not militias a year ago. Anybody can use that name, but under law, the term militia means a citizen-based but government-organized and regulated military-type body. And the term militia, unfortunately, has been distorted by groups like the people involved in the January 6th uprising last year.
Thanks for that call. And that's a change I think you've written about, Bob, between the idea of a collective right to own firearms in a well-regulated militia and an individual right to own and carry firearms. Can you talk about that transformation?
Well, sure. I mean, the Supreme Court brought that into sharp focus back in 2008 when they ruled for the first time that the Second Amendment provided a personal right of average citizens to have guns for personal protection in the home. And that kind of pushed aside the militia part, but that wording is still in the amendment. And more to the point, the militia-based focus or understanding of the Second Amendment was how it was interpreted in the first 200 years of our history. And the old-style militias don't function today the way they did back in the 1700s and 1800s. And that's partly why the understanding of it has become obscured, but the government still has full regulatory power over what's called militias. And just because somebody says they're a militia, it doesn't make them a militia.
Thanks for the call. We'll go now to Andrew calling from Minnesota. Andrew, hi.
Yeah. Hi. Thank you for having me. Everything that my man just said there was informative, and I appreciate you for being here and sharing all that. So, like, I first turned you on and heard the Republican senator, he was, I think.
Assembly rep, but close enough.
talking about the bill that he was writing. And, like, I think it's a shame that it doesn't include, because he was saying, like, hey, we could, as long as we're going to treat all adults the same, like, this arbitrary change between 21 and 18, like, specifically in regard to firearms, like, that seems like everything he said about that seems super reasonable, right? It's just a shame that the bill doesn't actually advocate for making it to where it's like 21 across the board, given like everything that the guy, the gentleman who's sitting there talking with you now was talking about. Like, I mean, who wants to give 18-year-olds more guns and to have them like in some capacity where they're going to be specifically used like as a weapon, right? For in the instance of concealed carry. And like,
I gotcha, Andrew. Running a little short on time. Bob, a consistent adulthood standard of 21, I think Andrew is getting at.
Well, and that's a perfectly, you know, reasonable public policy argument you can make. And one of the reasons there's great concern about 18 to 20-year-olds is precisely we know that gun availability and easy handgun availability is closely tied to child suicides and also to violence. For example, 73% to 80% of school shooters got their guns from their homes or the homes of relatives and friends. So when handguns are readily accessible, and usually it's handguns that are used, by the way, not assault weapons, that when handguns are readily available, teenagers will sometimes blow a cork, they'll go up and shoot up a school or decide to kill themselves instead. And that's part of the problem with that in-between age of 18 to 20.
In our last couple of minutes, Bob, a thorny issue. I know one people have tried to research a lot over the years. What does concealed carry, the prevalence of concealed carry, do when it comes to crime rates, particularly violent crime rates? Do we have any kind of solid conclusions at this point?
Well, there are some pretty clear conclusions. There was a book that came out some years ago called More Guns, Less Crime, which made that exact argument, that the more guns civilian has, the lower crime rates are. But it turns out that that data was not properly presented. And when other people looked at that data, it proved to demonstrate basically the opposite. And in recent years, there have been some important studies, one in particular, that found that violent crime increased from 13 to 15% in states that had loose carry, civilian carry laws compared to states that did not. So there is a correlation between more violent crime and more proliferation and carrying of guns by civilians in society.
I know you're always watching for the latest developments in gun laws and court rulings around the country. What kind of things do you have your eye on right about now?
There's a very big case before the Supreme Court. It was argued back on November 3rd. No telling when the court will hand down its decision. It's a challenge to New York State's concealed carry law, which has a fairly strict standard. And I know about that law because I obtained a concealed carry permit through the New York State law process. And it's being challenged as essentially too strict. And it looks as though the court is poised to strike down that law in part or in whole. It's hard to know how far they are going to go. But one thing is clear to me, which is that the Supreme Court didn't agree to hear a challenge to the strict New York concealed carry law to also rule that to then uphold that law. I don't think they're going to uphold it. We just don't know when that decision will come down. It could be as early as March, could be as late as June. That'll be a very important case.
Bob, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
Good to be with you.
That's Robert Spitzer, Distinguished Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the State University of New York College at Cortland. He's the author of over a dozen books, including 5 on gun policy. He talked to us today about concealed carry and gun ownership under age 21. Earlier, we talked to Republican Assembly Representative Shea Sortwell, sponsor of a bill that would lower the concealed carry minimum age in Wisconsin from 21 to 18. Still time for you to share your thoughts on that and read more about it over at WPR.org. Catch up with the news coverage on that and share your thoughts in the comments section. You can also always tweet us at Central Time WPR. Let us know what you think. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, we'll meet some of the most significant women in the history of science and find out why their stories are often overlooked by history. We'll check out some of the individuals, hear their stories, their discoveries, and what it all means for the future of science. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. You might like cinnamon rolls, a lot of people do. You might like chili, very popular. But have you ever eaten a cinnamon roll in a bowl of chili? Turns out it's a thing. As reported in Smithsonian Magazine, cinnamon rolls served in a bowl of chili is something that people eat. And it's not a newfangled food fad for the hipsters. It goes back at least 100 years. It's a regional thing. The article said some places in the Midwest do it. Looks like that meant Nebraska. The origins, some say it was started in lumber camps. Others point to school lunch programs where cinnamon roll chili was a regular entree. Looks like it's mostly gone now from school lunch menus. That's a lot of fat and sugar in your main course there. Some restaurants do serve it, especially in Nebraska. Have you ever run into this? I want to know about it. Right now, please. Email or as soon as you can do it, ideas at WPR.org. That's ideas at WPR.org is a bowl of chili with a cinnamon roll plopped down in it, a part of your food history. Two great tastes that taste great together. This is Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a pair of Appleton musicians have been working to share the music of Latin American composers with a wider audience. We'll learn about their project, Strings of Latin America. Now, many technology companies are turning their attention to the online virtual world known as the Metaverse. Just yesterday, Microsoft spent close to $70 billion to acquire the game developer Activision Blizzard, which it says will provide them with building blocks for the Metaverse. Walmart and Nike are among companies who have filed trademarks for their products in the virtual world. But the concept of the metaverse is still loosely defined and foreign to most of us still here in the physical world. Our next guest teaches a class entirely in virtual reality, and he's here to help us understand the hype. Jeremy Bailenson is the Thomas More Stork Professor in the Department of Communication and founding director of the Virtual Human Interaction Lab at Stanford University. Jeremy, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me. Good to be here.
So people are hearing the word metaverse. Can you give them the elevator pitch on what exactly that means?
The metaverse is people, places, and things. People are avatars, representations of us as we see each other in a virtual world. Places are a persistent, meaning it's always there and it's always the same location where you can meet. And then things are objects, virtual versions of, could be shoes, could be houses, could be anything you could imagine. So loosely speaking, we think of the metaverse as virtual people, places, and things.
And the phrase metaverse comes from the Neal Stephenson novel, Snow Crash, I believe. I read it a long time ago. It was this flashy, super lit, super crowded place where I might have a samurai sword fight with somebody. What's the reality of our virtual reality online world right now?
Yeah, so the metaverse comes from science fiction, the term itself, and a lot of virtual reality, both on the technology side and on the research. We look to science fiction because these are the people who've been thinking about this for quite some time. But when you look to the world now, there's really three instantiations of the metaverse. Number one is you're wearing a VR headset and you are seeing other people's avatars and you're fully immersed. And when you think of those metaverse, there's places like VR Chat and Engage and Rec Room, and there's a couple thousand people per day on any one of those platforms at any given time. The second version are these 2D spaces similar to what we used to have in something called Second Life, where you use your mouse and your keyboard and you walk around VR. And a lot of these 2D spaces now, for example, Decentraland, they're being driven by NFTs, these crypto-based 3D objects, non-fungible tokens. A lot of the energy that you're seeing from these marketing companies, when you mentioned in the intro, for example, Nike, they're thinking about these 2D spaces. And then if you're expanding to 2D spaces, you have to think about places like Roblox that has 200 million monthly users, where you've got kids that are kind of playing around in their own metaverse. The third and final instantiation, which is very different from the first two, are those that do augmented reality. They want to map the planet. And so people that create these games, for example, Pokemon Go, you've got to create a version of the metaverse that maps geographically onto the physical world. So three different versions of the metaverse, all of them using that term, but very different in terms of their applications and the technology behind them.
With the virtual reality side of things, I've seen you quoted elsewhere talking about a lot of their potential right now being the world of work and of training. Can you talk about some of the potential that's becoming real now, not just potential?
So we like to joke, the original use case of virtual reality is from 1929. And it was the flight simulator. And despite all the flashy things that you can think about VR to be used for, the one application that continues to endure and to be the true killer application is training. So I've co-founded a company called Striver. We began by training quarterbacks here at Stanford, then in the National Football League. Eventually, we moved to enterprise training companies. So we've trained over 800,000 Walmart employees who put on the goggles and then were instantly transported into Holiday Rush the day after Thanksgiving to learn how to handle the cacophony of all of those customers, or how to find a safety violation by looking around. We're now installing VR to 4,300 Bank of America across the country, where people will be able to train on how to talk to customers in a way that's better. And, you know, people talk about the metaverse, but what they often forget is you have to have a reason for somebody to go to VR. And why we like corporate training as the foundation for the metaverse is we know that it's a proven application, and everyday employees are spending time putting the goggles on. And we believe that as the metaverse gains traction, what's actually going to drive it is not going to be these fun marketing employees, but it's really going to be, you know, figuring out how to do your job better with training.
You've taught a class completely in virtual reality where everybody's wearing the goggles. You teach classes without it. What have you learned about when this is a useful tool and when it is not?
Thank you for that question. It's exactly the right one to be asking. And so we taught two classes in VR here at Stanford. We had 263 Stanford students. Over 6 months, they spent over 200,000 shared minutes together. This is minutes where they were in a room together, seeing each other's avatars in their own dorm rooms wearing the headsets, but feeling like they're together. And some things work really well in VR. For example, if you're building something, you're designing a space, or if you want to have proper nonverbal communication. So on Zoom, if you are looking at a person on your screen, other people don't know where you're looking. But in VR, if you turn your head to look at a person, a third person in that room room can see where you're looking. And if you point your finger at a fourth person, everyone can see the spatial coherence. They know where you're pointing. So where it was an epic win in our class using VR was, first of all, doing amazing things in VR, for example, building spaces. But second is really feeling this community of being together. We call it social presence.
We've talked about work training. We've talked about education. I'm a big nerd, Jeremy. How about entertainment? What is on the horizon there?
Well, the thing about entertainment is that it's not broken. So I always think about VR for, let's solve really hard problems. Like, how do you train someone on how to, be in a very difficult situation? For example, if, training firefighters that's a great use case because it's hard to do that. I don't like using VR gratuitously. And what works really well right now for your email is your phone or your computer. And what works really well for watching a movie is a screen. And so I'm not seeing the home run use cases that are purely entertainment based. And that's simply because entertainment is so good on 2D screens. It's unclear yet how 3D and having your body tracked in VR really adds to that.
Interesting. Jeremy, thanks so much for joining us today.
I really appreciate you having me, and have a fantastic day there on Central.
You too. That's Jeremy Bailenson, the Thomas More Stork Professor in the Department of Communication at Stanford University, with us today to talk about virtual reality in the online world of the metaverse. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a journey to a Hmong New Year celebration.
Like many festivities, Hmong New Year celebrations were put on hold in the first year of the pandemic. Some gatherings returned this last year, including a New Year celebration at Sheboygan North High School. As we continue to settle into 2022, Gong Sue Xiong brings us the sounds and voices from that event.
I sat in the gym and watched as the opening dancers began their performance. People were quickly snapping their grand entrance photos before pouring in to join the main event.
Hmong New Year is a time to celebrate, gather family and friends together, make new friends, and find soulmates.
Sheila Ya is the co-chair for Hmong Mutual Assistance Association, the organization in charge of hosting this year's Hmong New Year in Sheboygan.
I think COVID played a role that gave a lot of individuals, families, friends, and the community a different perspective. It gave them a way to see a different way of life, that gathering means something to you. So this year, it brought out everyone back to spend time with each other.
The lobby is also full of people. There are people waiting in line for Hmong food. The menu consists of rice, chicken, papaya salad, and so much more. And there's an even longer line of people ordering bubble tea. There are vendors selling fruits and vegetables, clothing and jewelry, and other merchandise. Fashion is very important in the Hmong culture. Most people today are dressed in a jacket with embroidered textile, a white pleated skirt or black pants wrapped under a waistband. And of course, the entire outfit is adorned with beads and jewelry. You hear that jingling sound? That's the sound of coins. Silver coins are also a big part of traditional Hmong clothes. Historically, these coins represented wealth.
Everyone is dressed up in beautiful outfits.
Meng Xiong is a sponsor from the Wisconsin United Coalition of Mutual Assistance Association.
You know, I love the Hmong New Year. I grew up going to it every year. We get to showcase talent with dance, singing.
Bei Jiu Long Gao Hmong means our young Hmong woman.
And the pageants.
The best performers win a trophy and up to $1,000 in prize money, which they often use to cover travel and clothing expenses. The hallway next to the stage and audience is bustling with dancers preparing for their performances.
When I did perform after COVID-19, it was just really exciting.
Pamela Va is a dancer from the dance team Ling Mom Hong, which in English translates to Hmong Sisters.
I know a lot of dance teams they had a lot of ideas, even more ideas throughout the pandemic, and they have become a lot more creative. You're just ready to come out and show everyone what you got.
take these opportunities to come join us. I would say challenge yourself to immerse yourself in another person's culture. We have a lot in common. You just grow so much as a person when you open your heart and your mind to other cultures. So come join us.
Gong Sua Xiong brought us that story on a Hmong New Year celebration in Sheboygan. She's a student at UW Milwaukee. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lola Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast and find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, the Strings of Latin America project is raising the profile of composers and making their music more widely available. We'll talk to the two Appleton musicians behind it. That's next year on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. In the conversations we have about representation and diversity, one area that might not immediately come to mind is classical music. Our next guests are 3 years into a project with ties to Lawrence University in Appleton that's trying to change that. They say there's a lack of access to music composed by people who aren't white Europeans and Americans, and that's a big problem for musicians and composers. Natalie Herrera-Pacheco is director of research for the Strings of Latin America initiative and research and intern coordinator for Lawrence University and the Sphinx Organization. Natalie, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. It's so nice to be here with you.
And Horacio Contreras is artistic director for the project and associate professor of music at Lawrence University. Horacio, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Horacio, let's start with you. Can you tell us how the Strings of Latin America project got started?
Yeah, of course. This project is the result of an initial research made by Venezuelan cellist Germán Marcano, who is a very good friend of mine, who started in the early 2000s researching music from Latin America for cello. He back then published a catalog of music for that instrument in the form of a book, but there was a small number of books printed in that time. And I always admired that book. I used it a lot. And in 2017, I spoke with Germán and came up with the idea of making this resource available for a larger number of people through an online platform. That's when I also spoke with Aaron and Afa Dworkin from the Sphinx organization, and they were gladly interested in the project, and that's where everything started. We published the first catalog there in 2018, and then this has been growing since then.
Natalie, can you talk about the work you do, the research you do, including with the students from Lawrence University, to try to find and collect this music?
Sure. Well, I'll say a little bit more about the project.
Sure.
Once the Sphinx cello catalog was published, we started seeing that our project was already involving other tasks. So those tasks were also attracting other people from the music community. So that's when we decided to create our own initiative, which is Strings of Latin America. And there we do research on Latin American music written for strings. We also do, we catalog materials, and we are constantly updating the catalogs. Right now we have the cello catalog, but also the viola catalog. We write biographies for Latin American composers. We create educational videos and presentations in order to show the music heritage from Latin America.
Well, let's hear, go ahead.
Yeah, and with all these new tasks we have this internship program. And this happened through our partnership with Lawrence University and the Sphinx Organization. We offer students from Lawrence and from several institutions around the country the opportunity to join us in our effort to research projects and learn at the same time the challenges and the rewards of working with this wonderful and sadly unrepresented music.
Well, I want to hear some of the music, of course. And Natalie, can you start us off by telling us about the first bit we're going to hear? This is from the first movement of the Concerto for Cello and Orchestra by Ricardo Castro. Can you tell us a bit about it before we listen?
Sure. This is a very interesting piece. Ricardo Castro was a Mexican composer, and he was active at the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th. And this is the first cello concerto written in Latin America, and that's an important document, of course, for the history of this instrument. And he composed that, we believe, in at the beginning of the 20th century. It was premiered by Lovenson in Paris, and the concerto chose a romantic style. You will hear like very clear that, probably influenced by the cello concerto written by Camille Saint-Saëns, and that's with the cello concerto by Ricardo Castro.
Here's a listen. Excerpt from Ricardo Castro's Concerto for Cello and Orchestra. We're talking about the Strings of Latin America project associated with Lawrence University. Horacio, could you set up our next piece now? Ricardo Lorenz, his piece Cecilia in Blue and Green, some of the third movement called Green. Can you tell us about it first?
Of course. Ricardo Lorenz is a Venezuelan-American composer born in 1960. He is the head of the composition department at Michigan State University, and a very good friend of mine. And this piece was commissioned by Mexican cellist Carlos Prieto, and is inspired by Ricardo's mother, Cecilia Abreu. The piece has three movements, Blue, Cadenza, and Green. And Green has a lot of influence from the music of the Caribbean.
All right, here's a listen to this composition by Ricardo Lorenz. Cecilia in Blue and Green, our technical director, is rocking out to this one. Horacio, I understand you know the cellist very well on this one.
Yeah, I know him very well. I actually was born with him because the cellist is me.
Well, and that brings me to my big question here, Natalie. Can you talk about, obviously, the hope of this in part is that musicians now and in the future can perform these songs, right?
We are very happy because we will have our first edition from the Ricardo Castro's concerto very soon out and available for people. And this is so exciting.
Yeah, it is very exciting. We're really working very hard for people to get to know this music and for them to have access also to information about the composers and hopefully in the very near future to scores that we will be producing.
And Horacio, are you seeing people already use the catalogs, both the ones that were before your project and now what you're assembling? Is this getting used by people in their performances now?
Yeah, I get emails all the time asking me about works, about information. And I actually have a very, very sweet anecdote of a high school student that approached me in an event that I held in South Carolina for a large number of students there. He came to me and he asked me if I was the author of the Sphinx catalog. And then he thanked me because through the catalog, he was able to find a piece that he was practicing at that moment and that he really loved. Mm-hmm. So that was very sweet to learn from this high school student from South Carolina.
And Natalie, in our last few moments, how exciting is it when you are able to get your hands on this music and know you are keeping it around, keeping that musical heritage alive?
Well, it's in a very personal level, it's very important because it's also a way to be at home. is a way to like build bridges between being here in Wisconsin and looking to the South and see that this music is here, that can be here and can be available for other people, and that can help to create those bridges between this society and our societies there.
That's a good place to leave it. Natalie, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
And Horacio, thanks for being with us.
It was wonderful. Thank you so much for having us.
We've been talking to Natalie Herrero-Pacheco, Director of Research for the Strings of Latin America Initiative, and Horacio Contreras, Associate Professor of Music at Lawrence University, the group's Artistic Director. We talked to them today about their work to research and catalog and then share information and music from Latin American composers with the hope of preserving them and having people perform them. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, alcohol-related deaths have been on the way up in Wisconsin over the last 20 years, and the pandemic didn't help. We'll check out a report on the rising toll of alcohol in the state and look at some possible solutions. Plus, college enrollment is down over the last couple of years, with community colleges among the hardest hit. We'll find out why and how those colleges are responding, that and more, tomorrow here on Central Time. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio, and then we'll take a closer look at who remains unvaccinated in the United States and an effort showing some signs of success at boosting vaccinations here in Wisconsin. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.